In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favorite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
Search up In the Fale to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Neat and Footy with Sam Wykes and Jinirao Arona on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, kia and kia ora to all our listeners across the Pacific. Welcome to Neesian Footy, the number one place for Pacifica footy news and stories in both rugby league and rugby union. My name is Tinirau Aruna, and alongside me each week is my koi, Sammy Wykes. Sammy, how are you, brother?
Big
how was your weekend?
Big T, my weekend was fantastic. It was my old man's birthday. It was my father-in-law's birthday. And we played a bit of golf, actually.
Oh, yeah? How'd you go?
Actually, playing a bit of golf is a bit loose there. We hacked at a bit of golf. Took a bit of grass with me. Five holes, took about 5 hours. So
bag of shovels, not clubs, eh?
That's the one, mate. That's the one. But good day out. Father-in-law had a great day, and that's all that matters at the end of the day. But we have a massive show planned, T.
Oh, do we what?
Rugby massive. League. Wow, that delivered on the weekend.
One of the biggest moments in rugby league history.
South that we Sydney will cover Roosters.
Very shortly with Alex Johnston. The PNG people, very proud of this rugby league legend.
Absolutely.
Not only will we cover rugby league, NRL, round two, we'll cover Super Rugby, but you've managed to get one of our biggest guests here on Neesian Footy today, and we will be interviewing him on our show, and I'll let you do the honors.
The great man, Eddie Jones, probably one of the most influential coaches in world rugby. He's decades and decades of coaching. He's going to his sixth Rugby World Cup next year.
As a coach.
Like, that's unmatched. And we're just going to dive into his coaching experience, man, because it's been pretty colourful. Reached out to some past players to get their insights on Eddie, but this is a wonderful chat. If you're interested in knowing what it's like to coach and get the best out of players, environments, this is the chat for you.
This is the one. You think of the amount of experience that this bloke has had, the amount of different players that he's had to coach, the different personalities that he's managed. He would have that many teachings to teach all of us on how to, you know, get the best out of rugby league or rugby union or any athlete.
So he's the man. Eddie Jones will be on later on in the show.
Moment of the week.
Moment of the decade. Moment
yes.
of the century.
We should have just changed that ID just for this one moment of the decade.
Huge moment.
Talk to me, T. Think about all the players, the greatest players, greatest wingers of all times that have played rugby league. I don't think Alex Johnston probably sits there in terms of like talent-wise and the freakish talent and probably the hype, but he has come through with an unbelievable milestone that probably won't be broken for, I don't know, another 100 years or something.
Yes, Alex Johnston, AJ, a.k.a. AJ, 213 tries.
Right.
He beats Ken Irvin. He had this record since 1973. It's been 53 years since this record has been broken. And on the weekend, last Friday, against the Sydney Roosters in Sydney, he runs away and scores the 213th try. And then you just see the floodgates open and all the fans just running onto the field. What a moment in rugby league.
The only thing it was missing for him was the win. It just would have really topped it off nicely. It's only fitting that I said around the athletes and the freakish athletes and the wingers that have played, but I think it's only fitting that the way PNG are around rugby league, that they hold a record like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, isn't it? Big shout out to Alex, man.
And he's been on our show here on Neesian Footy.
Hey, can we play that ID, please, after this?
Let's give him some love.
Hey everyone, Alex Johnston here from the PNG Kumuls, the South Sydney Rabbitohs. You're here with Neesian Footy.
NRL, round two, Sammy. We've had the milestone moment. We've had some huge games already. We've had Vegas. Geez, what a start to the season.
I'm still loving some of your predictions. Like, not in a good way. Like, you called the Newcastle Knights around how they will play this year, moving the ball and having a different energy about them. And they certainly proved that against Manly.
They did, especially losing their two key players in Kalen Ponga and Dylan Brown, but still being able to go out and still be able to move the ball. From what I heard in camp, they do a lot of skills games. So with my coaching, we're going to stick to a bit of skills games and working under fatigue. But one game that stood out for me, the West Tigers at Leichhardt. They missed round one due to a bye, so they had to wait that extra week. They come up against a team that played in Vegas in the North Queensland Cowboys, but they were just dominant. They looked gelled, and they win this game 44-16 to the Tigers. Did you watch this one?
I missed this one. I was watching the Moana game, actually. It was on the same time, Moana and the Blues. But
we'll get to that.
How did Jerome Luai go?
Player of the match.
Oh, stop it.
He stood up. He led like a leader, directed the team. I thought the way that he directed in attack, he had 3 try assists, and then he scored 1 try of his own. Do you know one of those kicks where there's not much doing, don't kick to the corner, and then Andrew Johns, I think he used to do it, kick towards the goalpost,
yep,
and just see what happens.
So see if you can get the bounce back.
So he kicks it to the goalpost, bounce back, he picks it up and scores under the post. So
them training tries, man, how good.
Another player I want to shout out is Jarrell Skelton. He had 20 carries for 221 metres, but the reason why this one's special, Taylor May came off 16 minutes into the game due to a shoulder injury. So Jarrell Skelton, with the new interchange rule, they had a specialised winger in Skelton to come on and replace Taylor May. And then he goes out and scores a try himself as well.
Round two, with these new rules, especially around the interchange, it seemed like it worked a treat for Newcastle when they lost their 2 halves. They were able to get some specialists on there. Now with the Tigers, are you feeling like it's actually a good rule change for the game in terms of so it doesn't drop off or doesn't blow out? In terms of the intensity of the game?
Oh, good question. I think the way that I think about it is those two players that do miss out, what happens to them the week after and the week after that? You know, are they going to be restricted in playing any footy?
Mm.
And then by the time they get to week 2, week 3, does a coach have the confidence to put those players onto the field if they need to?
If they
to,
haven't played?
If they have to, if they haven't played.
Yeah, gotcha.
For so match it has fitness. A knock-on effect.
Okay, so a bit later on in the rounds, we might get a bit more, a different story.
But yeah, Tigers win this one. Luke Laulili'i, he scored 2 tries for the Tigers as well. One where he intercepts in that picture where he's just running down Leichhardt on the field, and then in the background you've got the hill with all the orange, black and white jerseys, and they're just screaming. He puts the ball down and scores a nice try for his team, but they get off to a good start. Another one that I want to cover was yesterday's game on Sunday afternoon, the last game for the round, the Titans versus the Dolphins.
My Titans were close. That smoke, the smoke and the lock. Talk to me. What, they were up 12-0, weren't they, T?
They were up 12-0, and then in the 52nd minute, Kulikefu Finefeuyaki scores a try to get the ball rolling for the Dolphins. The first 2 tries for the Titans, Jojo Fifita, he scores, but PNG star, young star, Cooper Bai, he goes in, barges through, or pretty much goes in untouched to score a try for the Titans before Kulikefu's try. Now, in the last 10 minutes, the Dolphins were down by 2 points before the Samoan international Hamiso Tabuai-Fido. He scored the match-winning try, catching a kick off
off the boot of Isaiah Katoa.
Isaiah Katoa. The Hammer also ran for 325 metres. So, Dolphins, they
325 metres?
Yeah.
Holy.
Yeah, yeah.
He got through some work, eh?
A couple breaks there and, got through some metres. So, plenty of news going on. The Panthers were dominant. The Melbourne Storm were dominant. So far, Longo scores a hat-trick as well. But we are just getting started. There's more coming this year with rugby league.
Just before we move on to rugby union, Sua, his performance, 3 tries. He just looks like he's just having fun in the backyard, out in the villages. Like, where do you see him getting to? Like, what status are we seeing him getting to if he keeps it at this rate?
I think him being a part of that spine, when you've got Jerome Hughes, Cam Munster, Harry Grant, it's allowed him to have, you know, be him, and he can just have fun. They'll give him space. But the other thing that I've realized is that he's matured his game to, he's not trying to do it every single play.
That's the big one, isn't it? Trying to force those moments.
It's about being patient and waiting for that moment to come. And then it's like, oh, this is my moment. And then he does a 360 spin, runs through and scores a try. So like his last try that he done.
But like hard work puts you in the picture to score. Like you don't have to chase it. Like your hard work and effort and the way that the Melbourne Storm play, it's going to open up if he's in the picture.
Being in the right position, having to run from one side of the field to the other, seeing shapes and just the amount of practice away from the field. During training with his spine, that's why he's in those positions to score three tries. So great work to Sofa Longo, and I'm keen to see how he progresses. And, man, maybe a smoky, not even a smoky, Daly M fullback of the year.
Oh, that's a big call, but yeah, it's not out of the question.
There's some great ones out there.
Some great ones out there, but that's not out of the question at all. T, is that all you got for rugby league?
That is all we have time for. Let's switch over to rugby union.
Hi, my name is Mata Mata Ele, and you're listening to Nisian Footy.
All right, T, yes, Super Rugby Pacific, the Drua, they got the job done over the Brumbies in front of a sold-out crowd in Bar. Not a seat, not a blade of grass, not a tree branch was actually available. Did you see any of the highlights?
I haven't seen none of it. I was waiting for this. I wanted to.
Oh, man.
So I want you to paint the picture. You paint the picture to me.
It was that packed there at that stadium. That when they panned around the ground, you saw these trees just bouncing up and down, and they zoomed in. There's about 20 people inside the tree, like jumping down on the branch, watching the game. Like it's only in the islands you ever see something like that. But thankfully, from what we've heard, no one got injured. But that crowd, they were electric.
Do you know how many? He said 5,000 tickets
were
sold.
They were pre-sold, so they haven't had that before. And then the others would have been walk-up. So I think they would have had to been 10,000.
10,000, you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely. But it sounded like 60,000.
And this is the only field that's rectangle in
Fiji? Yeah, no athletics track around it.
Okay.
So normally there for soccer, but this time rugby got their chance and didn't it deliver. So
hot
as 30, they said it was about 35 degrees.
And the Drua beat the Brumbies.
Yeah, they beat them over there, bro.
you didn't see this one coming,
no,
otherwise
we
would have picked them.
But I did think it would be a pretty decent game just because of, maybe they were their second game at home. They're always hard to beat at home. But when I think of when Nems has come on, well, I guess what has Nems always said when he's come on our Friday shows around how they want to start?
Oh, fast starts.
Fast
they even start. Got him.
He even got his accent, his Kiwi, his Brisbane accent down.
He goes, yeah, mate, we just want a fast start, get them fast start. You know we can finish well.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, to be honest, they didn't get off to their fast start at all. But I think that's probably the difference, though, like the noticeable difference is the fact that, you know, they still talk about this fast start and it didn't happen. But in previous weeks when they didn't get the start that they wanted, like the body language was off.
Mm.
You know, it was like they were disappointed and deflated, but there was still 75 minutes of football to be played. This time around, the Brumbies scored first after 5 minutes, but their body language was up. They didn't look phased under the goalposts.
Mm.
And then their next effort, so their next action, when they kicked off, Nasova just absolutely steamrolled through off a really good kick chase. Like pump the winger and they get a good turnover off the back of that. And then they score not long after, but like that happened. So it didn't go their way the whole time. They gave away two yellow cards as well. So they were down to 13 men at one point.
V15.
And they didn't look phased. Though that was the most pleasing thing that I saw, is that they actually still looked like they had the upper hand. They had the energy more than the Brumbies and they had two less players on the field. So I thought from that point of view, their energy was on and their defense was solid too, because when they had those two players off, the Brumbies were attacking the line. They were going after it, trying to pick and go and through that, but they just held strong and they got these turnovers. And probably the same way when we saw them beat the Hurricanes a couple of weeks ago, is every mistake the Brumbies made, the crowd got louder.
And the energy lifted.
The energy lifted.
Yeah.
And that was the difference for the Drua. I thought they handled the moment. They handled playing in front of their home crowd very well. And it was just pleasing to see that they looked like they were happy when they were playing.
Did their confidence and energy grow as they just continue to score more points? And then did the, probably from on the back of that, did the style of their attack shift to going back to the old Fijian draw away where they start flicking?
It's funny you say that. It's because so at halftime, they were actually up 20 points to 12. And then the rain came down in the second half, pouring down. And there was one of the tries on the right-hand side where, yep, you think they'll just tuck it under the wing, but it was just flick ball straight at the back to lead to a try. So I think they kept their flair, yeah. You know what I mean? It just seems like there was just one of those days where once they've got the momentum, just can't stop it. You just let them be. But one of the feel-good stories that came out of this, though, T, was one of their try scorers, Sairusi Ravundi, their hooker on debut. He was working at the water factory in Fiji on the Tuesday and then got called into the squad. And then so he's part of their development squad with NEMS and then has to start, got the privilege and honour to start on the weekend. He scores a try on debut off a mall try. Like, oh, he was good. Happy as. But
did you say he worked in the water factory?
Worked in the water factory.
And then just got called into the squad.
Ready to go. Ready
he
to
would
go.
Have been, if you're listening to last week's Nijin Footy Fridays and NEMS was talking about when they train, they don't get lunch. He would have been that.
He would have been that person. Yes,
they don't get lunch after the training. The academy team.
So it was a big day for the Drawers. So it was actually a very big score too. So they ended up winning 42 points to 17. So it was a good win. That's two from two in. They're looking to go. Sorry,
two from three in Fiji.
In Fiji, and
one from one in Bar.
There you go, 100% record there. And they're back in Fiji this week against the Reds. So they're looking to make it three in a row. So hopefully they can do that and move up the ladder. We'll shift over to Moana Pacifica. Moana on this one wasn't a good day for Moana Pacifica. It was afternoon footy at Eden Park against the Blues. They went down 43 points to 7. And look, this one, there's no sugarcoating. The Blues were just too clinical. They were direct. They went straight through the guts of Moana. And they choked him out type of thing. Like, you know, the pressure was relentless and they just had no answers. Moana for this game.
On the back foot.
Like, they had some moments, but it just wasn't enough. You know, their forwards just went through them. Bowden Barrett kicked to the corners and had a really good kicking game and they just couldn't find a way to get any other points. But what I do want to highlight is the stuff leading into the game. Like, Tanner came out and said that, this is his quote. He said, "We've got nothing against the playing group, nothing against the staff because he's worked at the Blues before, but the people that make decisions have made it very hard for us, being Moana Pacifica, to survive over here." So he's had a shot at the Auckland Blues, obviously being in the same city, feeling like they don't have any pull.
And when I mean any pool, like
around probably facilities, player pool and development and funding and all
any
of that.
Any support
compared to the Blues, which is probably not wrong. The Blues responded after the game on social media with a caption of, "Did our talking on the field."
You know what, I'm actually loving these social media battles.
Yes.
Where they're like little slight digs. There was one on the weekend where the Roosters posted a door and like, you know, close the door on your way out or something.
Really?
But just pretty much saying that Sydney Roosters, this is their home.
This is their home.
Not South. But
mate, the battle of the content creators, I think they need to... you know, some of the content creators actually past players as well, so they've actually played the game, so they probably can throw a bit of shade each other's way. But on a serious note, though, for Moana, it is actually very hard for them to compete in Super Rugby Pacific. Like, I know they might have similar funding, but the Blues have New Zealand All Blacks top-up money. So I think, you know, for someone like Bowden Barrett, he's on about 800K. Someone like Patrick Pellegrini, he's on 100K. Like, but that's like the disparity between the two teams, because you're not getting the top up from Tonga. You're not getting the top up from Samoa. Like, it is what it is.
They knew that coming into the competition?
They did know that, absolutely. And they knew they were going to be behind the eight ball. But this is what I love about rugby league and the way that when they enter new teams into the competition, there's still a lot of setup for them to be successful. You know,
they want it to be a competitive competition. They don't want these blowout scores.
You just don't want a number... just to fill in a number and tick a box, we've done this. So moving forward, man, I think someone like Oceania Rugby, where Frank Pulitua is. Like, they don't have a team. They look after all of Oceania. But they should own Moana Pacifica. That way they can feed the pathways, there's funding in there, and then Tonga Samoa can actually have some genuine talent if they were going to get like match payments from them, from their test matches, to then go, okay, I can play for Moana and I can feed into our test teams, which is what it's supposed to be. But at the moment, they're still not getting those stars right at the peak, other than Ardy.
Last question on Moana Pacifica. Do you think having a successful year last year, having Ardy Sevilla, that helped, and then now not having Ardy Sevilla, they're starting to see some of the effects of not having him to be able to, you know, not use him as leverage, but having that person within their doors to say, hey, we need this, we need that, and then they get that extra support.
Oh, I think that you lose a bit of that street cred when he's not there to be able to have more
pool.
But
then you still got Tana, the OG.
You still have him, but remember, like at the end of the day, like a coach can only do so much. Like it's the people on the field, player-driven, someone's still in their prime. You need players like that, but you just can't rely solely on one player. You need systems in place to make sure that you're competitive. So hopefully they can change it a little bit, because my fear is that Moana might not be here in the future if we keep seeing these lopsided games. So hopefully it gets sorted and they can turn things around very soon.
Are you meaning by sorted funding for better players or funding for support?
Everything. I just want Moana Pacifica funded and supported. That is us until we get to Eddie Jones.
Hello, Lere. My name is Hare Tāpore. I'm the CEO of Pacific Rugby Players. You're listening to Nisian's Footy.
All right, T, I am actually pretty nervous and very excited about this chat with our next guest. He is honestly one of the most influential coaches in world rugby. He's led the Wallabies twice, Japan twice, and England. He's also been part of South Africa's coaching staff. And when it comes to coaching at Rugby World Cups, honestly, unmatched. Next year will be, I believe, it will be his sixth Rugby World Cup he's coached at. He's a man that spent decades shaping players and teams across the globe. Eddie Jones, konnichiwa, kite kurete, arigato gozaimasu. Yoroshiku onegaishimasu. There we go. Eddie Jones, welcome.
That's not a bad multicultural introduction, mate.
You like that? So that's what I remembered from my time pretty in good. Japan still. But before we get into our footy chat, Eddie, how is your Japanese?
No, pretty ordinary, mate. It's that bad. My wife's Japanese. We've got a new dog. We've had two dogs. This is the second one. But she doesn't allow me to speak Japanese to the dog because I teach it bad habits. But I give it a go. Yeah.
Wow, unreal.
We'll get to your coaching and also how you communicate to your Japanese team.
And dog.
But Sammy just mentioned, you know, off the top, the number of teams that you've coached and the experience that you do have and been to a number of World Cups. But I'd like to know, you know, what is your proudest moment off the footy field?
Well, it's always the players that come back to you, mate. You know, one that comes to mind is Des Tuivai. You know, West Harbour great, played for Brumbies, New South Wales. And I can remember going to watch Dan Parks, who was all the rage at West Harbour, having a look at him as a Brumbies coach. And then I saw this tearaway flanker just absolutely demolishing people. And it was Desi, found out a little bit about him. We signed him, and I remember we signed him for like $25,000. He was right at the bottom of the budget. And within a week, he'd spent all his money. lost all his gear, but he's one of those guys that keeps coming back. You know, I was reasonably hard on him, he ended up moving to the Netherlands. And when I was the England coach, he was starting a club, so I went over a couple of times with him, helped try to build his club for him. And it's those sort of things that, you know, make you feel good about the game.
Yeah, those relationships are so important. And Desi Tuivai, when I was a young kid at on the hill watching him play number seven there with his fuzzy hair, he was one of the reasons. Him and George Smith was one of the reasons why I wanted to, you know, stay with rugby. But you mentioned you were hard on him. Like your coaching style, you know, I guess you hear it from everyone else about the way you coach. But in your time, like what, how has your coaching style evolved? But also what still stayed true to this day that, you know, when you first picked up that whistle, that this is still me to this day, but what else has evolved?
Well, I think one thing that hasn't changed is just the standards you need to have. Like, the game's demanding, and if you don't train to those standards, you don't get the consistency of performance. So you need to have the standards. I think the big thing that's changed, Sammy, is the way you go about it now. Like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you could be quite direct with a player and tell him as it is. And now it's not that the players are softer, they're just different. You know, every generation's different. And if it wasn't different, it would be pretty boring. So now it's more about trying to guide them to the solution and getting them to come up with the solution themselves rather than being so blunt with them. So it's much more about engaging the players now. And if you think about, you know, we've just been coaching in Japan under 23s, just had them in camp, and I was talking to a few of the young guys. You know, and they spend a lot of their time on Netflix. And, you know, most of them watch Netflix at a speed and a half. You know, and apparently on YouTube now, you can buy a special membership where you can watch it four times the speed. So they want things quick. You know, it's about getting to the end. So you got to understand all the changes that are happening with young people now and try to adapt your coaching to that.
Mm. Our audience is, you know, across the Pacific, and, you know, what we try and do here on our show is give tools back to the people listening, and a lot of the listeners are, you know, either parents or Pacific athletes themselves. And, you know, being a coach over so many years and being able to coach Pacific players, you spoke about standards and, you know, times have changed and, you know, being able to adapt. How have you seen the Pacific athlete from, you know, when you first started to now, you know, has there been growth as, in particular, those Pacific athletes that you coach?
It may be covered in a couple of different ways. But the first way was, I reckon, when I first started coaching, Pacific players were generally stereotyped. You know, powerful, not particularly hardworking. And I think they had to carry that for a while. Like, and because I was from a mixed background and was brought up in a fairly different place, you know, I was brought up in La Perouse, where the general population was 50% Aboriginal, you know. So it wasn't a different place for me to be with people who were different. And I always sort of tried to engage the players just as humans, just as different people. Like a Todd Ikefa and a Wendell Sale were completely different. And you tried to just make sure you didn't get into that stereotyping of the players and make sure you looked at each player as they are. And, you know, the growth of Pacific players in rugby generally. You know, I was listening to some rugby league show the other day, and they were saying, you know, how they've changed the representation rules. So they've allowed a more flexibility. And it's a direct result of the influence of Pacific players. And you think about any World Cup, you know, Tonga generally has three teams at the World Cup. You know, one that wears a Tongan jumper and all the rest wearing a multitude of jumpers. You know, coaching England, I was lucky enough to have the two Vunipolos. And there was a great example, you know. Mako was brought up by his father, quite hard, you know, had to get out of the car and run, you know, it was old generation. Whereas Billy was brought up by his grandparents, you know, and grandparents generally don't say no, you know, they say yes to anything. So you have to handle Billy very differently than Mako.
Man, that's a good point. We're definitely going to touch on some of those names that you've just mentioned. But Eddie, I remember you shared this pretty powerful story about your mum being refused help that home while your dad was serving in the Vietnam War because she was Japanese. And you said what that experience taught you was around tolerance and getting on with it. But what else did that teach you around people's character under pressure and probably learning how to connect with, I guess, a number of different people outside of just, you know, tolerance and getting on with it?
Yeah, I think just never getting bogged down to a situation or a stereotype, allowing yourself to just be in the moment and try to realise, right, what have we got here? What are these people thinking? And not try to hold a grudge to that, because some people, unfortunately, are educated poorly, like, and that's part of life. But you can't hold a grudge against them because of that. They don't know anything better. They only know what they know. So try to be above it as much as I can. You know, when I was growing up as a young kid out of La Perouse, half Japanese, like I used to cop it, mate, you know, and no one even knew Japanese words. I never held one grudge. I remember actually going to Ella's once and asking for advice, how am I going to handle this? And they said, just give it to them back. So then I became quite good at sledging, you know, because that was the way to survive. So then I basically had a rugby career that was based on sledging, you know, thinking about the game, trying to disrupt oppositions, and that allowed me then to be coached. So there's a good thing that can come out of everything.
Mm. You definitely suit the rugby league world when you're bringing the sledge in and being able to hold your own in them dressing rooms. One thing I like to say, or I've said to people, is some of the books that I've read, and there's not many at all, but I've been about 5-6 years ago, I came across your book, and I loved reading stories or books about coaching. And one thing I learned from your book was you adapting when you taught or when you coached different nations, and you suited that nation's style to the way that you coached and the way that they played the game. You know, when you've coached Australia, Japan and England, you've used what that culture was about and you've been able to translate that. Where did that philosophy come from, or where did you learn that style of coaching?
I think it was probably the first time I went to Japan, mate. I remember going to Japan, being half Japanese, I thought, I'm going to be part of the crew here. Yeah, because in Australia, you're half Japanese, you're not really part of the crew, you know, you're a bit of an outsider. So I thought maybe this is a chance. And I can always remember I was coaching Tokai University, you know, not a high-performing university, it was hard yards. Anyway, there was a social event and I didn't get invited. And I remember going home and I was a bit disappointed, you know. And I remember speaking to my wife and she said, just remember, never think you're going to be treated as a Japanese. Just be yourself. And that was probably the biggest thing I learnt, was just always be yourself, but try to understand what that culture's about. Like, you know, for a lot of the Pacific Islanders, the family's the most important thing, isn't it?
Mm.
So if you come from an understanding, that's the most important thing. And then players can sometimes have problems because of that, because if they're in a mixed marriage, that can lead to tensions that you wouldn't normally understand. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got to try to understand that for them. You know, the English love to be polite, mate. You know, they hate having conflict in front of people. Japanese love being punctual. You know, South Africans don't like swearing. So there's one or two things that almost typify the culture that you try to make sure you fit in with, and then the rest of it, you just try to be yourself.
How do you do that when, say in Japan, like there's a lot of Tongans and Samoans and Fijians that have actually represented Japan? Like, how do you mix all of those cultures into the national team?
Mate, it's the hardest thing to do, I reckon. You think about any team, and you guys have played top sport, you know, the most important thing you have for a team is its identity, how you know you want to play, how you know you want to act. And when you've got people of really massive differences in the way they think and the way they brought up, to get them together on the same page is the greatest challenge. And generally, mate, I don't think I'm that good at it, but what I am reasonably good at, I'd say, is being able to identify players that can help in that area. Like, for instance, in that 2015 World Cup, we had a guy called Michael Leach who didn't want to be captain, but Kiwi, but spoke Japanese brilliantly, married a Japanese lady, and he could bring the two groups together. Because, you know, whenever you've got different groups within your team, they'll always gravitate towards each other. Like, you know, you go into any room and if there's Tongans there, the Tongans will tend to go in a corner, Samoans will go somewhere, the mixed group will go somewhere and the white guys will go somewhere. That's the nature. And if you've got one or two people that can understand how to bring them together, so, you know, we'll say maybe sit with whoever you want, but one meal a day, go out of your way to go and sit with another group. And that just helps. Those little things just help.
Mm. Right, just on that 2015 World Cup, obviously it's probably going to go down as one of the biggest upsets in history Japan beating South Africa. I reached out to Hendrix Tui, and I just said, mate, what were those camps like? And he just talked about, you know, training at Sanic's home ground, brutal, you know, in terms of those preparations. And Kaan Hesketh was selected from those camps. But he said that feeling of prepping for that long against South Africa, but the feeling after, like, he felt Japanese, you know what I mean? Like, even though, like, he's Samoan heritage, but what it meant to him and what it meant to the fans. But what did that mean to you as a coach, that you got the job done against probably the favourites?
It was more about, I always thought Japanese rugby could be better than it is. Like, yeah, when I had an experience as a Samoa technical advisor for 6 months when Michael Jones was coach. And I always think back then, I'd love to go back to Samoa and help them find their true potential. You know, you see these teams, they almost fit the story around them. Like, Japan's not supposed to win. Japan's just supposed to give entertainment. Samoa goes and be physical. But why can't they be better than that? You know, and you know the smaller countries can't win consistently against those big countries. It's just impossible. But you can play to your potential, and that means that if you catch a team that's a little bit off on that day and you're at 100%, you can get them. So, you know, for me it was about Japan fulfilling their potential. And, you know, there's a good little story about Hendy. I loved him, mate. And him and Marley Sal, who was a fantastic player, you know, one of the most talented players, gone to Japan when he was young, 21, I think. Yeah, he could have been anything. He had a big right foot step. And we're in the midst of, like, really heavy training. And we went to Sacramento, I think it was, and we had a early morning on the bus. And anyway, everyone's on the bus. We're missing two blokes, Hendy and Marley. Yeah. And they came in, you know, out of gear, wandered in. I remember my inclination was to go nuts at them, but I thought, oh, no, I better just wait. So I remember we met afterwards. I said, what's the issue, boys? And they said, oh, we just needed to get out and relax. and it's true, you know, that's what they needed to do. So we just got on with it after that. And I think we got good performance out of both of them for the rest of the World Cup. And some, you know, you got to identify that with players. You know, you need hard and quite strong, you know, team behaviours, but you need also flexibility. Like, Andrew Walker's another one, mate, one of my most favourite players. Like, what a player he was.
Special. And
we signed him from the Roosters. And I remember we were going to South Africa with the Brumbies, and he said, mate, I can't go. I said, why? He said, you know, if I go on tour without my wife, it might be difficult for me. And so, you know, this is talking about the early 2000s where women weren't allowed to be part of the team, you know. So I went to the senior players, asked them, I said, what do you reckon? And they said, no, get him to bring his wife along. So he brought his wife along. He used to have McDonald's every Friday. Like, you know, and that made him play well. You know, he was the leading try scorer for two seasons.
I bet you would have loved signing him away from Roosters, being a Bunnies fan yourself.
Exactly, mate, exactly. I wasn't too pleased with the result on the weekend, mate.
Yeah, we'll get to that one shortly. But being a ex-Rooster myself, it's bleeding red, white and blue, so just waiting a little bit longer for that one. But when you speak, listening to you speak about, you know, some of your coaching styles and relating to people, it sounds like, you know, there's a percentage of understanding the game and coaching the game and tactics and stuff, but a lot of coaching as a head coach is understanding the person, understanding their cultures. Do you think that that's just come with experience, or did you get to learn that at a very young age on how to adapt and how to understand people to be able to get the best out of them?
That's a good question, Mark. I look back at my own experience as a player, and I remember we had a bloke called Bob Dwyer who won the World Cup in 91, and he was flipping tough, mate, tough coach. But I always remember the first game I played for Randwick first grade, you know, I was like 75 Ks ringing wet, came in the first grade for a club championship game, And I remember he came and sat next to me on the bus and he just said to me, he said, how do you think we're going to go today? And by doing that, he made me feel important. So I had a really good mentor, and then I had a guy called Jeff Sale at Randwick who was not a hard guy but a lovable guy, just loved. And he watched his players. Like, you know, I remember playing a trial game and I was a bit off the pace because I was still playing cricket. He said, oh, you need to do a bit of running, mate. So, you know, we used to have to do 6 400s every Tuesday at Randwick. Imagine doing that now, Sam. Get around. He said, boys, 6 400s, here we go.
6 400s.
And that was the start of every Tuesday session. So I went out hard in the 400s. I remember saying, he saw me after the next game where I played a bit better. He said, I told you to help you. Yeah, so it was just, I had really good mentors in that. So probably when I was younger, I probably prioritised the game more. And as I've got older, I've realised that, you know, it's always care before correction. There's a big important thing about coaching. Care for the players and then you can correct them.
I love that one. Oh, yeah, that's for my next coaching speech. Nah, how good's that? But I spoke to Gitz as well, so I've gone through the phone book here and just to get some things off some of the players. And Gitz tells his story a lot around his 21st birthday during the 2003 World Cup. And you told him, mate, you can't have a beer. And he's going, yeah, sweet, mate, I want a beer. And then he tells the team dinner where Mortlock and that came up to him and goes, mate, have a beer. And you're screaming from the other side of the room, say, Gitz, mate, have a beer. The boys want to have a beer with you. And, mate, he's laughing telling this story. Like, he sent it through a voice note, but he asked, mate, Eddie, like, the psychological side of footy, like, what reaction, what outcome do you want from, say, saying that behind closed doors, but also, you know, having a bit of fun with it, I guess, out in public in front of the team?
Oh, I think you always got to have a bit of fun too, mate, don't you?
Yeah.
I reckon that's really important. And yeah, in the old days it was easy, mate, because players used to drink together. You know, there was still that old rugby culture, and now basically that's gone out. So you got to find different ways to have fun. But, you know, a young guy like Gitz, you wanted him to find his own way. You know, so if he had the strength to say no to those players or just have a couple of beers rather than towel himself up, then that's a good step in the right direction. And, you know, you just have a look at his career, the discipline he was able to play for his whole career. Like, we had him at Suntory when he was 38, and I was there as an advisor. And I remember, you know, they used to train pretty hard, Suntory. And I said, mate, maybe you take the half the session off for the main session today. He said, no, I'll do the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the good players have that discipline. They work out what they need to do and they keep doing it. George Smith was another example, mate. Like, he loved a beer. Like, you know, or more than one. He loved plenty of beer. But he'd always, after a game, he'd be first in the gym on the bike. Like, I remember they told the story at when he was playing at Toulon. They couldn't work out why he'd do that, you know, because they wanted to recover and he'd be in there working. And allowed him to play what until he was 38, 39 and still be a good player.
Yeah, man. Look, I see some of those players that you've coached, no angels, but, man, they're good people and you'd follow them because they led with action. You know, Toto said that he nearly missed the leadership group when you named him vice-captain in Argentina that time. But when you think about those great players, you know, George Smith, Michael Leach, Toto Kefal, you know, you've got the Vunipola brothers. What characteristics did they have that you loved?
Well, I think you just think about all those guys. They're all characters. Like, they all had a strong personality, but they also had appropriate work ethic. I think, you know, appropriate's the right word. You know, some players need to work like almost 24 hours a day to be successful, in exaggerating, where other players just need to look after their body more, you know, and they need to be more sensible about training. And you just got to work out what's right for you. And I think as you get older, the good players really work out what's right for them. You know, if you look at rugby league now, Sherry Evans, like 37, he looks as fit as a fiddle, doesn't he? Played 80 minutes on the weekend. Like, he's worked out what he needs to do and keeps doing it. Because at the end of the day, you've got to love it, don't you? You've got to love playing and you've got to love training. And it is a hard like rugby league and rugby union, they're both physically hard sports.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned earlier was the glue men in teams, and you know, it just reminded me when I was in England, and yeah, there was a few Pacific players that played in different teams and would always come together. But what our coaches wanted, or our clubs wanted, was how do we bring the teams together? So I remember would have one of the boys put a pig on the spit across a fire. Yeah. It was cloudy, it was wet. And when he was just standing, his name was Itu Uasali, a Tongan fella. So he's just there whining the pig. And we got invited all the English players to come in and join us in the feed. And, you know, just that moment there for where they got to understand our culture, and, you know, we got to invite them in, and then we got to connect as a group. You know, over your time, who has been your favorite or your top glue men that you've been able to coach or witness throughout your coaching journey?
Oh, Todd O was pretty good. Todd O was outstanding, mate. I can remember we played, I think it was New Zealand, and we got beaten pretty badly. We had a training session, and we were pretty average. It was at Coffs Harbour. And I remember saying to Kev, I said, we've got to amp this up. And he single-handedly changed the session just by his intent. And he was that sort of player. He could feel what the team needed, and he could do that on the field and off the field. But he had that larrikin about him, you know, which I think is such an important characteristic, you know, to be able to be serious but also have a laugh at the appropriate time.
Man, we used to have him on every Friday with us, and he was the best with everything, yeah, some of his old school stories. man, I know we're probably running out a little bit of time here, but I just, one thing that I really want to touch on before we finish up, one of my the favourite quotes from yourself is around when you said that the All Blacks have the best, three biggest academies in the world, Tonga, Samoa and Fiji. Like, that's gold, and it's not wrong, especially even for the Wallabies and that, but has world rugby done enough, considering the amount of Pacific Island talent that has fed through the systems across the globe? Have they done enough to be able to help out the actual national teams compete at the top level?
I'd say yes and no. I think in terms of funding they have, okay, but I don't think in terms of tournaments they have.
Yep.
Yeah, I think the best way for the Pacific Islands to get stronger, and I think Fiji have shown it, you know, you want to have something of a super team, you know, that's playing in a top competition where the players on the island who are the best players get an opportunity to play professionally. And then your very best players can always play overseas. You know, that's the reality of the economics of the island. And then underneath that, you want a second team. And I think if they were able to provide competitions for those teams to play in regularly, that would be the way that Fiji's probably as close as anyone to reaching its potential, but Tonga and Samoa could become far stronger than they are at the moment. And I think, you know, Tonga and Samoa, I think, are really at risk in rugby union. I think NRL, from what I hear, you know, and it might be wrong, have done a lot in those areas to encourage players to play rugby league. You know, and as you boys know, they're physically equipped to be successful at rugby league. But there's always been a strong rugby culture in both of those countries. But if we're not really diligent in making sure rugby stays an important part of the society in Tonga and Samoa, we'll lose them to rugby league. Because NRL are doing everything right. We know they've got more money, but it's not about money. It's about intent and about having a strategy and looking ahead. And then a small amount of money can make that work. But I think that would be really important for Tonga and Samoa, and that really worries me, honestly, really worries me. You know, I'm happy for rugby league to do well, don't get me wrong. But, you know, we want a balance there, and we don't want Tonga and Samoa to be completely NRL.
Mm.
Yeah, you're not wrong, man. I'm with you on that. I heard one of the high schools have stopped playing rugby in Tonga, yeah, because of rugby league. So, yeah, hopefully we don't lose them to rugby. Eddie, I know T's got to have one more question with you, but for myself, I don't know if you remember back in 2002 or 1, I had you at Vic Barracks there for my very first taste of Eddie. And I can tell you right now that impact that you had on me and understanding, okay, if I'm going to be serious about this, man, I need to get some discipline in my life and work a lot harder. But I just want to thank you so much for jumping on with us.
I only have
greatest mistake Australian rugby made, mate, was stopping that national talent squad.
The NTS squad.
Think about all those young kids that came through, mate.
Yep.
That's I know, mate. They got to do that again.
Yeah, I think you
mentioned that before, Sammy.
Yeah.
My only last question was, I spoke to Nija Daly, and our show airs across the across Papua New Guinea, and Will Guinea being a big PNG star. Now, Michael Chow, who also hosts another show, he said, was it true that Eddie Jones once called Will Guinea when he started a fat little bloke?
He was definitely fat, and he was definitely, but he wasn't so little, mate. he ended up with a nickname Dolphin because he couldn't swim. because he was, when I went to the Reds, and I had a poor season there, but I remember Will was knocking around in the academy because they thought he had a poor work ethic. No one wanted to touch him. And I remember seeing him play, mate, and he could play. He was just one of those kids who played. So we had a couple of meetings. I remember his father came down, who was a education minister or quite a high parliamentarian in Papua New Guinea, and had a serious chat. And Will just changed it around from there. And what a career he had. What a player. What a player.
Mate.
I can relate, mate. Brian Smith called me fat all the time when
I
first
started. I can relate too, man. I think we all can relate at some point. You know, Digby, one last one actually. This just came to me. Digby said that you made him carry a footy for 6 weeks straight, breakfast, lunch and dinner. That one's true as well.
That's true, mate. He started to catch the ball after that.
Eddie, it's been an absolute honour, man. All right. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure,
we're very
boys.
Blessed
keep
to
up,
have you.
Keep up the good work, hey?
Legend, mate. Cheers.
It, mate.
Take care.
Legend,
mate, all the best. Cheers, boys.
Give me three answers for this one.
Yes, this is our game of Give Me Three, where Sammy thought he was asking me the question.
My heart just dropped and I was like, I'm not prepared, but you said it is you, so perfect.
What was last week? You done the music.
Oh, that's right,
you
the
know
music
why?
Challenge.
It's the Friday show that gets us a bit mixed up.
Yes, it is the Friday show.
But yeah, you've done the music challenge and I got three from three. But this is our game of categories. We keep a score. At the end of the year, the loser has to buy the winner a jersey for this
jersey
one.
Jersey of their choice.
Jersey of their choice.
What have you got for me today?
All right. Well, Alex Johnston.
Yes.
Give me three Nijan players in the top 20 current all-time NRL try scorers list.
Okay. Daniela Tupou is one of them.
100% he's one of them.
Is he fourth?
He is fourth.
Who else is their all-time try scorer over the years?
I mean, you'll get that one. That's like a given. That's like,
that's the one. Yeah. So I don't get a donut. Yeah. And
you know,
I'll probably know both of them. Or no,
you know,
majority
both of
them.
Oh yeah, they're not from like the 70s or 50s. Yeah. 300 gamer. He's not a winger.
He's a center.
He's a star.
Superstar.
The star. He's Tongan.
He's Tongan as well. I knew I should have looked at this list.
You know this guy. Come on now.
I didn't know Nella. No, at the moment. No, that's popping into my head. That's all I keep thinking about.
When I say his name, you'll be like, oh, my days.
All right. Give me a club then. And it won't count if I get it.
No, you'll get it. Roosters.
Roosters.
And Panthers.
And Panthers. Michael
up.
Jennings.
Oh, my days.
Don't count that. That's awful for me.
And then the last one.
Who's the last one?
The Beast.
Manu Vatuwai.
Yeah, I thought you were definitely going to get Michael Jennings.
Nah, I've totally forgot about Jenko. There we go. Who are the other ones on that list?
I think they're the only three.
From Pacific Island Heritage. Okay, there we go. See, not a bad one. One from three. It's not
I
a great
we've
one.
We've already had this one too.
Nah, we probably could have, but it doesn't matter. Rinse and repeat. All good, my friend. All good. But that is our time up for Nijan Footy Mondays.
Thank you again, Eddie Jones, for joining us.
Absolutely. Make sure you tell your footy-loving friends about Nijan Footy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Pacific website. And we will see you again on Friday.
Ka kite. This show was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation.